Hi, I'm Nino Ricci, the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University, and this is Who Do You Think You Are? Each episode, we talk to someone from the Western community who is making a difference in their field by challenging old assumptions or forging new models for how we make sense of the world. These are people who are showing us that creativity lies at the heart of innovation in any field, whether it be business or law or history or the sciences or the arts. They're also showing us how creative solutions often come from building bridges across the disciplines and breaking down the barriers that often blind us to new approaches. I'm very pleased to welcome Jacob Shelley to Who Do You Think You Are? Like most of the other guests we've had on the podcast, you're someone who straddles a lot of chairs. You've got three law degrees, two from the University of Alberta and one from U of T. You've also got a master's in theological studies from Conrad Grebel, and you've served as the Vanier Fellow with the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. And here at Western, you've got a joint appointment in law and health studies and a cross appointment in the program in public health. So maybe you can just take me through this a little bit and tell me how all these different puzzle pieces add up to Jacob Shelley.
How they all add up to Jacob Shelley. That's an interesting question. So the law degrees were kind of an afterthought. At the time, I really wanted to pursue a PhD in philosophy or theology. And my partner at that time went to the University of Alberta to do her master's degree. And I did the student searching for what I want next, clicking through all the programs, and couldn't find any philosopher or program in the humanities that interested me enough to do a PhD. And I was just kind of clicking around and found the law school and thought, I should apply to law school. And I did, and I got in, and then I went. I didn't really think much more than that about it. It was an opportunity. And when I got there, I got connected with a gentleman named Tim Caulfield, who runs the Health Law Institute at the University of Alberta, and became a research assistant, did my master's with him. And that kind of put me on a trajectory towards legal education, legal academia, where I've now focused mainly on healthcare issues and public health issues. But it was kind of an accident that I ended up in law. And so the puzzle pieces were kind of jammed together, I guess, a little bit. But they fit because in my previous kind of academic pursuits of theology and philosophy, it was about words and ideas, and it was about concepts and how they work and how we as a community use these concepts to inform each other. And it's the same sort of thing I do with my legal education and my research and teaching. I like to think about how the words, how the concepts, how community works together. Pieces actually fit, but they're from different boxes, if that makes sense. And I've kind of created a mosaic now where I kind of straddle this legal academic world with a public health world that I'm not formally trained in, but I've worked extensively in, and I constantly bring in my background in theology and philosophy and to the table.
I mean, that certainly makes sense in terms of kinds of people we've been talking to, because most of them have exactly that kind of background where they've put together a lot of different pieces from different fields and created something that's fairly unique. Now, for you, I guess food has been a particular focus in your interest in law. So how does that come into it?
So yeah, food has been an interest of mine academically. I think we're all interested in food to some extent, usually. But academically, for a number of years, in part just because of the circumstances I found myself in at the University of Alberta, where it was around the time when the obesity epidemic became more at the forefront of education initiatives in schools, or, you know, there was a lot of talk about, at the time, the Pellman lawsuit, which was a lawsuit against McDonald's. So it was kind of at the forefront of what was happening in both law and public health in some ways, and it just kind of resonated and made sense. Because food is community, and I've always been interested in the aspects of community. And we all need to eat to survive. We all have choices around the foods that we eat that inform our communities, inform our interactions. And we can't really avoid food in any sector that we might work in, whether it be, you know, in private industry and for the government. Food is just constantly going to be an ever-present factor in decision-making, informing policies, informing, you know, day-to-day decisions, you know, where I have three kids, I have to feed lunch today at some point, and I don't know what I'm going to do for lunch. And so I'm on the way in today, I was thinking about, what am I doing for lunch? We're constantly thinking about food. And so it was an easy way to kind of get at some of those bigger concepts or issues around equity or social justice. If we're all talking about the same issue, then maybe we can use that issue to to explore or examine other concepts. And so I've always liked the idea of examining our ethics or our community norms and values through the lens of food, or our ideas of responsibility or obligation through that lens.
So maybe talk a bit about that. I mean, how does food reflect our ethical outlook and our societal views?
I had a desire years ago to start a website called One Tasty Cow. And that website idea came from Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation. And he talks about in that book about how, I might get the stats wrong here, but I think it was that a typical beef patty you might buy at a grocery store or at a restaurant could have meat from up to 1,000 different cows because of the way that we produce things. And even if it wasn't 1,000, even if it was 100, or even if it was 10, right, it raises this idea that we're the way that we've produced food has actually some real significant implications. Like, why do we need 1,000 cows or 100 cows to make one hamburger patty? And I was actually driving across Saskatchewan when I lived in Alberta. My family's still in Ontario. I was driving across the country, and there was this cow standing in front of a shed. And I actually stopped and took a picture of it. And in my head, I was like, I just want one cow. I don't need 1,000 cows. I just want one tasty cow. And I want that cow to have a good life. I want that cow to be raised in an environment where it can roam freely, where it can eat and enjoy its life, where there's an opportunity for it to socialize with other animals, where it's not in a stockyard, it's not in a feedlot, it's not in a pen, it's not living in the back of a trailer. And for me, that idea became kind of this jumping off point for me to think more about food decisions for myself, but also this idea that if people knew about the suffering of animals, if they knew about the agricultural practices that were being employed to be able to feed them the way they thought that they ought to eat, then they might reconsider their choices. And food choices are hard to make. Don't, you know, whether it be about the time to cook or the money to spend, there's lots of different variables that will impact the kinds of decisions we make. But I think that the kinds of decisions we make are reflections, if not implicitly, of our own values, of societal values. So the fact that it doesn't bother some people that a burger patty could have 100 cows in it, or 1,000 cows, for me became a point of, I just need the one cow. I want to raise it well, and eventually I might want to eat it.
So why is it so hard to have a one cow burger? Is it too expensive? Is it?
It's our standards of agriculture right now are factory farms and mass production. So we don't really produce in that way anymore. But it's also about cost. Like there's a huge cost associated with eating meat that's raised ethically. So you can buy ethically raised meat. It just costs a lot. And even someone like myself who thinks about this a lot, it's easy to get caught up in a sale where meat's half price or in value packs of steaks or buying meat at a cheaper price. And we do spend a lot of money on food in our budgets, far less in North America than they might elsewhere in the world. But I think we have a hard time with wrapping our heads around the cost of what it would of meat that would be ethically raised, particularly given our consumption expectations that we think we should be able to eat meat every meal or every night. And so there are movements, you know, Meatless Mondays type movements that are talking about eating less meat and recognizing that maybe meat should actually cost a lot more. Maybe we shouldn't be able to buy a burger for 99 cents like I did as a kid at Fast Eddie's or some of these establishments. Like maybe that's actually a problem, but we've become normalized to think that I should be able to get a burger for 99 cents. And so to facilitate that demand, there has to be some cuts or things have to be given away, and that's never going to fall on the part of us as the consumer. It's going to fall on the part of the animals or the producers. They're going to be the ones that try to absorb those costs rather than passing it on to us.
And I guess, you know, in addition to sort of ethical issues around the way we raise our food and process it, I guess there's probably a lot of issues around how we market it and package it.
Absolutely. Like part of the my research in the last couple of years is really focused on marketing to kids because there's an opportunity right now in Canada where Prime Minister Trudeau asked for a policy in place to ban the marketing on healthy foods and beverages. And so there's this policy discussion that's been ongoing. There's legislation that is before the Senate that is passing every day, I'm told. Maybe today is kind of the idea that it's happening soon. That's the expectation. But how we market food, how we package food actually has a huge impact on our perceptions of what we actually want to eat, what is deemed to be good food, even in, with vegetables, right? The grocery stores don't put on the shelves vegetables that may look abnormal. Like, there's an expectation that a tomato is going to look a certain way, or a carrot will look a certain way. So you don't buy carrots at the grocery store that have multiple stems off of them. Because we have an expectation of what it should look like. And I think
that has nothing to do with its nutritional value.
If it does have anything to do with its nutritional value, it might actually minimize it, because we might be going for vegetables that look a certain way rather than the ones that are grown in manners that might be more, you know, nutritious.
So why are we in a situation where we now know more about nutrition than we've ever known? We know everything we need to know to lead healthy lives and to eat healthily, and yet we seem to be seeing a decline in healthy eating. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think some of them are socioeconomical. Like, there's people that can't afford to eat healthy. It's much more affordable to eat unhealthy food to get the most calories for your dollar. But there's a whole bunch of a variety of reasons. I think there are many that are researching kind of our innate desire for things like sugar, salt, and fat. Biologically, are craving these to try to sustain ourselves over a long winter where we might not be able to have as much food, but of course we no longer hibernate in the same sort of way. Uh-huh. Our consumption patterns might reflect biological imperatives that now are unnecessary given our lifestyles. So there might be a lot of reasons, but I think I think a lot of people do try to eat healthy. I think there are misconceptions sometimes of what healthy might mean, but we're also in a food environment that makes it very difficult to make healthy choices. Even with respect to someone who might have very specific dietary needs, making healthy choices can be very difficult in an environment that is continually pushing a particular type of food product. And there's value to those products at times, but, you know, going to a grocery store and buying apples is a fantastic idea if you have the money to buy the apples and you have the time to process them if you're going to do something else with them, like applesauce or a pie or something. But even just apples, if you don't eat them, will go bad eventually, where a box of granola bars is shelf-stable. And so there might be other things that are driving people's choices that are related to their perceptions of health. So they might buy a healthy granola bar that has apples in it because they know that will last, where an apple itself might go rotten. Their experience might be that their kids don't eat apples in their lunches, or people aren't deliberately trying to go out and just eat unhealthy, but the environment makes it such that it's harder to make the healthy choice. Uh-huh.
And, you know, to what extent can we rely on the kinds of regulations there are around food to be sure that we're protected somehow when we go into the grocery store, that we're not having to read every ingredient or make 1,000 little decisions about the food, that there's some regulatory body out there that's making sure, well, this stuff is basically good for you, and I can give it to my kids. I mean, can we have that kind of security?
I think we do, actually, like in many ways. And I imagine if a grocery store could have upwards of 300,000 items. I can't remember the stats on what the average number in a grocery store. I think it's like 60 or 70,000 items. But there's a lot of food products that exist, and very few of them are we worried about when it comes to safety, because we often think of safety being immediate kind of harms. And so we think of outbreaks around E. coli or listeriosis or something that's happening in the food production, that becomes news because it's very dangerous and people start worrying about maybe consuming romaine lettuce, for example. But most of the products in our store, we do have a system right now that most of them are safe, if we define safe as I'm not going to become immediately sick, it's not going to cause me to have some sort of, you know, food poisoning or something like that. So historically that was talked about as pure food, the idea that the food's not contaminated. And I think what we maybe need to do is use the same systems that have tried to help create a safe food environment to then make it a healthy food environment. And I think safety and health here are can be distinguished, that you can eat safe food that's not going to make you sick immediately, but the long-term consequences of consuming that product might be other, you know, diseases like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, things that might arise because of the consumption of otherwise safe food. And so I think we have a system already that is reliable. If you think about it, the number of products that are shipped that need to be refrigerated and so forth, like, things do go wrong and the system's not perfect. It's a very complex system, but by and large, especially in the Canadian system, like, it works. Like, we have food recall systems. We have a system that is working for safety that maybe isn't being utilized for health.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that's where we could shift, and that's where some of the discussion around food labeling and so forth comes in, because some of the products might be safe, but doesn't mean that they're actually healthy for us to consume.
No, I think you also feel that the law has a role to play outside of, you know, government regulation, that there's a potential there for a kind of more direct approach to companies, say, who are promoting products that maybe have ill effects over the long term, that the law might have a role to play in that area.
Yeah, so there's anyone that's been to law school in the Commonwealth and has taken a torts course is familiar with a case called Donahue versus Stevenson. And this is a case in England where there was a half-decomposed snail in a bottle of ginger beer. And it kind of spurred on what we now call negligence law, this idea that we have an obligation to think about our neighbors and our actions and ensure that we're not causing them harm. And it really was an early product liability law case about a food product that caused, in this case, gastroenteritis. It caused an ill effect on the consumer. And that was not the regulatory state. That was a citizen suing the supplier of this particular ginger beer. And the law has long played a role in outside of the state regulating of holding producers and manufacturers accountable for the things that they put out under the market. What is interesting to me is that in the last, you know, couple decades, even though there are a few examples of lawsuits that have arisen, by and large, when it comes to food, people think everyone's informed and aware. As you mentioned earlier, everyone knows how to eat healthy, and therefore, why would we think about suing companies for the kind of products that we purposely choose to consume? And the best example is a case, Pellman versus McDonald's out of New York, where two teenagers sued McDonald's because they said, look, we're eating your food and it's making us fat. And they lost the case. And there's a lot of interesting things that could be said about that case. But part of the commentary that went along with that lawsuit in the media and in the academic literature was that people know how to eat healthy. And if you make poor decisions, you shouldn't hold a corporation like McDonald's responsible because you made poor decisions. But what it overlooks is the fact that McDonald's is deliberately, you know, promoting foods that are going to be desired at a higher frequency, or at a minimum, they're telling people you can eat our food and be healthy. And this is part of what I like looking at, is I don't think we should have to rely on the state to always step in, particularly given that the state is often has competing interests, economic interests, other things to consider, when there are very clear legal principles around the obligation for manufacturers to warn of the risks in products and to be accountable when those risks materialize. Where the debate arises is whether it's actually a risk or not, and that's where it can get interesting, and whether or not eating a burger on a Tuesday amounts to a risk if that burger itself is safe, right? Because only if you eat a burger every day for years to come that it might actually have negative impact. But I think there's actually precedent in the law to say the continued use of a product, if it's foreseen, if a manufacturer projects that this is how it's going to be consumed and they're aware of the risks, in my mind, they still have an obligation to warn consumers about that danger.
So would there be a parallel there with something like cigarettes, which clearly, you know, one cigarette isn't going to kill you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of where some of the, there's a lot of articles actually talk about tobacco litigation and then moving to obesity litigation and kind of making parallels. They're not always great parallels because there are, you know, you don't need to smoke. If you're addicted, you might be addicted to smoking, but there's no biological necessity to smoke. We all need to eat. And you can eat healthy foods, right, that can still have negative impacts. You can eat things that might still be healthy in their form, but the overconsumption of those foods could still have a negative impact. So it is a more complicated problem than cigarettes would be. And in addition to that, I think what makes it really, really difficult is that with cigarettes, we've typically thought of tobacco being associated with things like emphysema and lung cancer. We know that there's way more. There's about 65 cancers associated with tobacco products. We know it's far more negative impact than just what we're familiar with. But with food, it's a far more difficult story because we could look at something like lung cancer and say there's a direct correlation. If we can't make a causal link, we can at least say there's a real clear correlation between smoking and lung cancer. There's a lot of epidemiological evidence. It gets trickier with food because part of the problem would be Well, exercise, right? People can mitigate their food consumption. I play hockey a couple times a week, just pick up hockey. And after my game on Wednesday night, we went out for a beer. And one of the guys said at the beer, I earned this just before, right? Now, I didn't say anything. The truth is the calories we consumed were far more than the calories we burnt. I have no question about that. But the idea that we can actually mitigate the harms of food by exercise or by, you know, moderation, these are popular ideas that hold some truth, right? We can actually have a positive impact on our health through exercise. It overlooks the actual impact of food, and food is, there's some that suggest that obesity and overweight are 60 to 100% caused by food consumptions, and exercise, while important and necessary and beneficial for lots of reasons, might not actually be that important in the grand scheme of things. That's also that's also controversial, though, and that's part of where it gets more difficult than the tobacco example, where tobacco companies argue that your work environment or other pollutants were the cause of lung cancer, but there's a pretty clear correlation between the two, where food is not as – I think there are correlations that are strong, but it's not as clear.
I think, you know, before the interview, you were talking about something you called a wicked problem, which I think – is kind of describes what you're – maybe you could talk a bit about that term and how it applies.
Yeah, wicked problems are the idea that some problems are just so complex that there's not going to be an easy solution to them. And they become wicked problems because in food this is what happens, is that we could do, you know, an intervention. For example, we could subsidize fruits and vegetables. But that's not necessarily going to solve the problem. That's going to be only a part of a more comprehensive solution that's needed. And given that there are multiple layers to this problem, that there are numerous avenues, there's all sorts of considerations. You know, we're talking about food. Like that includes things from agriculture and production of machinery all the way to what's happening in retail and restaurant environments and in homes. And there's so many different avenues for interventions that the problem becomes really, really difficult. And I think it's often easier to focus on easier issues to solve because they might actually have an outcome. Where with food, even if we had the marketing initiative I mentioned, even if that unhealthy foods and beverages are no longer allowed to market to children, they're still going to be allowed to market to adults. And we know that children are going to see those ads. And they're still going to be allowed to do other things that are going to make it a more complicated issue than simply eliminating advertising. So a wicked problem becomes the kind of problem that is just has so many layers of complexity that it's not identifying the solution and applying it. There is no solution. There are multiple ways of approaching this. And some of them, even though they might be appropriate, they still might not work. They may not have success. And I don't know that means we shouldn't do them. There are some people that think that the labeling of food products will make no difference whatsoever in consumption patterns because it's really about economic drivers. And that may very well be true. I still think that we should have proper identification of products, but so it becomes a wicked problem in the sense that even if you have a great opportunity to try and solve it, it may not do any. It may not actually help.
Yeah, I'm having another moment of the kind I had in the interview with Lorelei Lingard, where I suddenly understood that, you know, what you're talking about here is really the same kind of problem that, say, a novelist faces when he sits down to write a novel, or an artist, that you're dealing with a reality that's so complex and has so many variables that it becomes very hard to separate them out in the standard kind of scientific reductionist way. So, I mean, I guess that's where someone like you who's coming, you know, who's crossing many fields becomes an essential player, someone who brings different paradigms or different perspectives. Creativity is sort of the issue we've been dealing with in this podcast as a kind of unifying theme. It's clear that there's a lot of room for creativity in what you're doing and in the approaches you're bringing. Maybe you could talk a bit about that, about the role of creativity. And
yeah, creativity, I think, is actually part of, since we talked last, I was thinking about this in respect to the legal profession in general. I think law has this element where there's always this creative spark that's ongoing, and novel litigation, new ways of challenging old problems. It's part of what the legal academy and the legal profession does, is how to solve problems that are persisting And certainly we have a very conservative tradition that's tied to precedent and tied to our, you know, our origins of where a case, you know, a principle in a case might arise or a doctrine might arise. But the legal profession in general, I think, has embraced ideas of creativity in its approach to solving these types of problems. Where it works in my work in particular is that, as I mentioned at the outset, I'm not trained formally in public health. And so when I started getting involved more, I'm not trained in science at all, actually, although they did say that theology was the queen of science back in the day, I don't think it holds that position any longer. So I have no real formal training in science. And so part of what I think I bring to the table in discussions is I think about it a little bit differently in terms of what approaches we should take. And in public health, you know, public health is the very often overlooked, neglected partner in healthcare. Healthcare gets the lion's share of the money and the attention. And so public health advocates have done a lot with a very little amount of resources, with very limited opportunity and expertise. We've started to recognize, particularly in Canada post-SARS, how important public health is. But historically, there haven't been, I think, a lot of freedom to kind of operate without real concern for the actual consequences. So public health, I think, in my estimation, is focused on real, they tries to identify points of intervention or ways of actually solving a problem that will actually work, because I don't have time to waste. And so I have the luxury that I'm not actually working in public health, so I can come in and think a little more critically maybe, or a little more creatively about how we can solve a problem. And I'm not saying that they're not creative in working in public health. It's just that I think that the confines of where they're allowed to operate might be slightly different. And there are, and science itself, which is a fantastic institution, you know, there are limits. Like, I'm not a scientist. I'm a legal policy person. So I'm not bound by what is the same sort of structure of thinking through an experiment or thinking through how to do research. The methodology in law is slightly different. Not to say that we're not evidence-based and we're not using science. We certainly are. But we have the creative license to go beyond what might be deemed the appropriate methodology. And that changes very slowly in science, where I'm not bound by that. And I think it's one of the advantages of being in this space, with that interdisciplinary kind of nexus, that I can be a bit more liberal maybe in my recommendations, although I often temper them, recognizing that this doesn't mean it's going to work, but I like to push those boundaries to try to make my colleagues in public health and my colleagues in law think more critically about the role of law in public health.
You talked a little bit at the outset about the influence of your theological studies, or the connection they had to your approach to law and your work in public health. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, sure. I just don't know where to stop. It's my main research in theology was about a guy named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German theologian who resisted Hitler. And it was part of the resistance to the Nazi movement. And ultimately, it cost him his life. He was murdered by Hitler at the end of the war for his efforts in the resistance. And I think part of studying that, irrespective of how the actual, like, thinking through doctrine or whatever might have influenced my legal thinking, it was more about the courage that Bonhoeffer had to kind of stand up against the system, to fight against the system, but also the courage he had because he was a pacifist, a self-proclaimed pacifist that became involved in, you know, plots that were ultimately aiming to kill Hitler. You know, he wasn't directly the one doing this, but he was involved in the resistance movement. And I think one of the things that I took away from that study was, here was someone who was very principled, very knowledgeable, had two doctorates, was brilliant, wrote a PhD dissertation at age 21 that is, like, brilliant, like, irrespective of whether you agree with him or not, it's just beautifully written, well-researched. Like, it's clearly a very intelligent individual who then looked at his surrounding circumstances and thought, like, my principles might be one thing, but what does the community need of me? And in fact, Bonhoeffer, during his studies, went at one point, it was in New York, and had an opportunity to stay in New York and avoid the war altogether. And had he done that, he'd very well would have lived beyond the war. And he made the decision that I can't stay in New York and have any credibility left in my community if I was to go back to Germany post-war. And so he went back purposefully to be able to have a voice, to have been there. And I think that kind of embedding himself in the thick of it is kind of where I like to be in public health and in law. I want to be part of the community struggling through these issues. And I think that's one of the ways that my background in theology has helped me. I think it's also been really helpful. Like, I grew up in a religious family as well. And I grew up in a very evangelical kind of environment where, you know, the John 3:16 thinking, which is a famous Bible verse, right?
You better remind me what verse that is.
So it's the verse that says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever shall believeth in him shall not perish but have eternal or everlasting life." And I haven't been to church in years, so that's embedded in my brain.
Yeah.
It's stuck there. And the John 3:16 thinking is like this idea of salvation and what we need to get to find favor with God, to get to heaven. This kind of idea was embedded in a lot of the religious upbringing I had. Like, if you believe, like, this is just this one principle is all you need. And I find that happens a lot in law. I find that happens a lot in public health. And I tell my law students all the time, when we get too caught up in what a case says, it's John 3:16 thinking. I use that term a lot.
Uh-huh.
It becomes very narrowly focused on one idea as being the solution. And I like to push against that. And I think Bonhoeffer did that himself. He was a pastor. He was a pacifist who became involved in this really complex, conspiratorial almost movement that it cost him a lot. It cost him his life, ultimately. And I don't think my work will ever cost me my life, hopefully. But I was inspired by thinking through the problem really, really well to understand why I'm acting the way I'm acting. And I think that's probably, those are the things that mostly I took away from theology. And then, of course, theology and law are both about dissecting and understanding words and how they're, you know, it's really language. It really comes down to the language. So
you've sort of created this field for yourself that doesn't have easy solutions and has so many possible routes of action. So what seems to you the best way forward, or how do you decide which path you take?
Oh, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I should say, like, you know, I'm fortunate that I, like many, stand on the shoulders of those that have gone before and really forged the path. So while there's not a lot of people in Canada that work in public health, I've been fortunate to work with a number of people that have in public health law, I should say. And so there are clear kind of some direction from watching my colleagues and friends that have gone before me and really carved out this area, like my mentors and Timothy Caulfield, for example, who's done a lot in the health law space. And I've been very fortunate, Canada's a small place, to get to know a lot of the major players in the academic world of health law. So I consider many of the best scholars in Canada to be among my personal friends. So I'm very fortunate to start out in that place. And that allows me some security to be maybe a little bit more bombastic or rambunctious than I would otherwise be. For me, one of the things I think that is really critical and that I'm trying to do with my career overall is to increase the scientific literacy of the legal profession, in particular with respect to public health issues. Like, I think a lot of the science that is before the courts, a lot of times we're talking about evidence, it's a different type of science than what would work in a public health issue, which is relying more on probabilistic kind of reasoning and evidence like that's from epidemiology or biostats. And so I think that's one of the paths forward, is to really try to build up in the legal profession the capacity to understand public health issues. But conjoined with that is also my desire to build up in the public health community a more robust understanding of the law and how the law is relevant and what the law does and what it can and cannot do. And so I'm fortunate I get to walk both worlds a little bit to try to grow the capacity of both fields. And the best path for doing that is, so far, has seemed to me to be to use the opportunities that actually are real, like Trudeau's mandate for a ban on marketing to kids. Like, there's a real policy discussion happening in Canada amongst advocates and public health researchers, and policymakers are involved, and the legal profession is going to be involved. There's lawyers for food industry making arguments. There's lawyers that work for NGOs making arguments. There's academics like myself that are involved. So this is a real opportunity to actually bridge those two worlds with real potential policy implications. it's very possible that the bill, which Senator Nancy Green Rain brought to the Senate, will pass in the coming days. In fact, it could have passed already, and I just haven't seen the news. I don't know. There's been days where it's like it could be by the end of today. And so once that passes, that might change the food environment, the food landscape, our marketing landscape considerably, and that becomes an opportunity then to engage with people on both sides of what happened and why and what could have been different and how could we approach this problem in a different way in the future. And so I try to find those types of opportunities to reflect on. But there isn't one path. There's many paths, undoubtedly.
So, you know, within the faculty of law, like where do you sit? Do you feel like
room 21?
I mean, I don't want to ask you awkward questions, but are you an anomaly? Are you something new? Are you?
Yeah, I don't want to say I'm an outsider because I very much like my faculty. I'm very been welcomed by my colleagues, but I'm on the periphery of law a little bit in that there are established, recognized disciplines in the law. And in the law school, I think a lot of people, or not necessarily my law school, but in the legal profession, legal academia, I might be described more as a policy person. I resist that quite often. Although I do work in policy, there's no question. I think the distinction sometimes is a bit arbitrary and superimposed. But I am on the periphery a bit, as health law is in a lot of schools. There's actually discussions of whether health law and public health is even an academic discipline proper. Is what I'm doing actually just a smattering of constitutional, tort law, property law, contract law principles all jammed together? And there's some merit to that argument, that what I actually teach isn't necessarily unique outside of other courses. So a lot of the cases that I talk about are cases that get discussed in other contexts and other classes because they're charter cases or they're constitutional division of power cases or they're cases like Donahue and Stevenson's that are the foundation of negligence now, and I teach them from the health perspective. And so health law is a bit on the periphery already. And then I would actually identify myself as public health law, which I think is even a little bit further on the periphery than health law. I think a lot of schools have recognized that, you know, there's a lot of lawyers that work in medical malpractice and in injury, claims for insurance, like that are all health related. The regulation of the healthcare system is enormous. There's a lot of legislation involved, a lot of regulatory systems at play. So you couldn't avoid health in a law school. But I do sit a bit on the outside, and then my other hat in the School of Health Studies makes me a little bit different yet because my role in the law school is limited because I have two homes at Western. So now I teach law in every home that I'm in. So in the public health program, I teach a law course on, and specifically related to, as much as possible to public health. In the School of Health Studies, I teach a healthcare law course geared towards future healthcare practitioners, potentially about rules around consent and so forth. And in the law school, I teach healthcare and public health law courses. So what I'm teaching is the same, but the approach I take, what I emphasize changes depending on the faculty. But I do end up becoming a bit on the periphery of what would normally be kind of considered part of the core of what the law is about. But I'm very fortunate. I have great colleagues, and some of whom also sit on that periphery a bit. Uh-huh. But yeah, I'm not an outsider, but I'm a bit on the edge.
Do you see that as a way forward in a lot of disciplines, that more and more people that sit on the edge rather than in the center following paradigms that have been long established? Like, how does your presence maybe shift the faculty of law in an interesting way and the presence of people like you?
Yeah, so I think there's lots of ways that it does shift that subtly and slowly to make that change, to recognize that maybe other considerations are necessary to inform and educate a robustly trained lawyer, right? But I think it's also, again, giving credit to those that have gone before me, recognition that this has actually been happening for many, many years. So mm-hmm. at Western, there's Robert Solomon, who's been here for over 40 years teaching in health law areas. He's worked a lot in drunk driving and in traffic safety. He's been working in that area and has established and carved out the necessity for it. So part of the reason why there's even opportunities for courses like that I teach are because those that have gone before and carved out that space already. But when we get into fiscally kind of constrained times, it's not the core. So health care law is never going to be the priority over constitutional law or tort law and property law. And I don't think it should be necessarily. I think it should be maybe it should be a core, but I understand why it might not be in the near future, where there might be other things that are identified as more necessary for the training of legal professionals. But I think that what happens when we start including what might be considered peripheral issues in law school curriculums and in who we hire, we start recognizing that there's a more diverse perspective and approach to law. So a lot of law schools are hiring indigenous scholars now. You increasingly see I'm part of a group, a food law association in Canada. There's now starting to be recognition that there's actually an area that we could call food law. There are folks that are working in areas like animal rights that there've always been legal issues there, but they're starting to be recognized, or environmental law. These things are starting to become more, I don't want to say mainstream because I don't like the term mainstream, but they're being recognized for having value and that they inform students, they inform the literature in new ways that have value, that add new perspectives. Uh-huh. And law has always been doing that. It's had, you know, the feminist movement, critical race studies movement in legal education has shifted. So there has been this continuing shift. And so I get the benefit that the work that went in before allows for a space where Western will hire someone like myself that has this bit of an oddball appointment. You know, I don't know a lot of people that have three appointments, but it's because there's recognition that there's something valuable in that appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fortunate that, you know, the dean of the law school currently worked with Professor Solomon for many years, also works in some health-related issues and recognizes the importance of this area. So it doesn't mean that it's always easy to get recognition. There's not a lot of conferences specifically in this area, especially in Canada. There's not a lot of journals that publish. There's still a slog. It's still hard to kind of get a voice sometimes, to get a platform. But increasingly, I think schools are recognizing the importance. And some schools have like an enormous group. Like Ottawa has a fantastic contingent of people that work in health law, from health systems to reproductive health to the health of immigrants and refugees to all sorts of things. So there's there's growing recognition of this, this area.
Is there, I mean, the law traditionally is very adversarial, and that's kind of the basis of it. Is there room for a different approach, a kind of more cooperative approach? I mean, in health law, where you know, go out and actually try and get companies to comply in a different way than the standard adversarial model, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the adversarial model is, you know, continually being reflected upon by folks that look at it and see how it's not really serving people as effectively as maybe we like to think that it is. I'm even though I advocate for using private law litigation like product liability law, I see the downfalls of the system itself and how it might not be the most effective way of bringing about change. But one of the things that ends up happening, if you have, and this is at least my hope, that if I can help train future lawyers to understand concepts like health in a new way, to challenge their thinking about health, that when they go out and they're working as counsel for, you know, a regulatory body or for a corporation, that that's going to inform their understanding of how to use the law. And will actually shift internally some of the what's happening. And I think we see that in how regulatory bodies, like, you know, colleges of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario or associations like the Canadian Medical Association or various public health groups are starting now to incorporate and respond to things like assisted dying. They're starting to recognize, I think, increasingly the role of law and trying to avoid the pitfalls of litigation by being proactively thinking through issues, which I'm sure has always been done historically to some extent, but it seems to be more robust and more systematic now than it was. You know, if you go back and look at policies from 30, 40 years ago for these kinds of bodies, there's a distinct shift. Now, that might be a response to the fear of being sued and being put into that adversarial situation, but it could also very well be recognition that we have an obligation to avoid that. It's not just that we want to avoid it, but there's actually an imperative to act appropriately at the outset so as to avoid infringing rights and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's been a fascinating conversation, Jacob. Thank you for coming in today to speak on Who Do You Think You Are? And I wish you all the best going forward.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
I'm Nino Ricci, and this has been Who Do You Think You Are? A Western University podcast.